Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. 26 tornadoes have touched down in Ohio this year. They've toppled trees, flattened houses, and tragically taken the lives of three people. Ohio is now second in the nation for confirmed tornadoes this year, ahead of all other Midwestern and Plain states. It's a trend that has some asking whether Tornado Alley is shifting eastward into Ohio or whether this year is simply an outlier. Joining us now to answer that question is Harold Brooks, a senior scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Welcome to All Sides, Harold.
How are you this morning?
So Ohio so far is second to Florida in the number of tornadoes in the first quarter of this year. Are we experiencing more than normal?
Well, you're experiencing more than normal, but normal in the tornado world is a difficult concept to come around because there's such a large amount of variability in most places so that you get to normal or you get to the average by having a whole bunch of few years and not very many other years.
So Tornado Alley, which I referenced in the beginning, it currently stretches over the Great Plains and includes Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas. And I guess the big question is whether it's shifting and whether this shift would include Ohio.
Well, not really. I don't think we can say that. One of the important things is the Tornado Alley isn't a really formally defined concept. And if you restrict the definition to something in the plains, you're including something other than just the raw occurrence of tornadoes. The big thing that distinguishes the plains of the U.S. is the fact that there's a really strong diurnal and annual cycle where we can be, you know, early to mid-spring in the southern part of the plains and a little bit later in the springtime is when we'll see the tornadoes. And almost all of our tornadoes are late afternoon in the evening. You go further east in the U.S. and that annual cycle spreads out a lot more, becomes less well-defined. So we've seen a little bit of an increase in the number of tornadoes in, say, the Mid-South, the Memphis, Tennessee area, and a little bit of a decrease in West Texas and Western Kansas. But it's really hard to tell that there's anything significant that's changed in the occurrence.
So it kind of sounds like we'd have to see more tornadoes consistently for several more years before scientists like yourself would start to feel more comfortable with saying this corridor is shifting.
Yeah, and by several more years, we're probably talking like 30 years.
Oh, okay.
So
a generation of years.
A lot of years. Right. And one of the real issues, though, is that again, in the with tornadoes, because of the variability, it's really hard to find trends. Because if from a statistics standpoint, you can think of it as that the standard deviation is really, really large. It's just hard to tell that a trend is there because you expect variability to happen.
So it does feel, though, like at least this year, at least in Ohio this year, that tornado season is early. Like I think of like late winter into early spring as like snow season, not thunderstorm tornado season.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a little earlier than you might normally get them. But given the anniversary yesterday, it's really hard to think of Ohio as being safe from tornadoes in early April. And earlier in the season. So that, yeah, you've had a few things that have happened a little earlier than normal, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean anything's changing. And it also doesn't tell you anything about what the rest of the season is going to be like. Just because you've had an early start to the season doesn't mean that, you know, the rest of the season is going to be really bad. And in fact, 1974 is a very good example of that, of not much happened in that part of the country after April 3rd. Now, April 3rd kind of made a really big impression so that it was a huge year, even though it was really basically one day.
Yeah. And for those who don't know what we're talking about, the Xenia tornado happened in 1974. It was the deadliest tornado to date here in Ohio. I want to say, what was it, 39 people died? It was bad.
Yeah. And it was part of a really large outbreak. It was one of the handful of largest days in U.S. history. Probably about 6 days that might be comparable in the last 150 years.
I want to pivot now to how meteorologists and scientists predict where tornadoes might touch down. Can you explain what a supercell is and how it forms?
Sure. A supercell is a is a thunderstorm that essentially the entire thunderstorm, the updraft of the storm, the air going up in the storm is rotating. And they form from, if we think about the ingredients that we need to have a thunderstorm to begin with, even a non-supercell, we're looking for lots of warm, moist air at low levels at the ground, relatively cool, dry air above that, some mechanism to lift that warm, moist air up, like a front or a dry line or some other boundary between air masses. And that'll get you a thunderstorm. And basically what you're seeing is we're lifting the warm, moist air. And when it reaches the point where you get to the cool, dry air above that, it becomes buoyant and it rises like a hot air balloon. And that's actually what a thunderstorm is. When you see the visual thunderstorm, that's the air going up rapidly. Now, to make that storm be a supercell that's more likely to produce a tornado, we need to have the winds in the environment the storm forms in, the horizontal winds, increase as you go up from the ground. And typically change direction. Typically, they'll blow out of the south at low levels and out of the west aloft. And when that happens, what's going on, you can imagine a spiraling football coming into the updraft of the thunderstorm and getting tilted to where it spins around a vertical axis. And that's the beginning of the supercell. And that creates the micro environment in which a tornado is much more likely to form.
Yeah, I've heard supercells described as tornado factories, essentially.
They're the best ways to make strong tornadoes. They're also the best way to make large hail. The fact that the storm is rotating actually makes the updraft of the storm stronger and helps hold the hailstone up. And so the thing that supercells are actually probably best at is making large hail. Tornadoes are sort of the thing they're second best at.
And when these conditions are present, when meteorologists see supercells, is that when we get tornado watches?
Ideally, we'll get a tornado watch when we see the conditions are coming together. We're looking for, are the ingredients in place? And if the ingredients aren't in place, is there some kind of process that's going to bring them together in the next few hours? And so a watch basically says over roughly the next 6 hours, over an area maybe the size of the state of Ohio, or maybe half the size of the state of Ohio, conditions are favorable for the production of storms that will produce tornadoes.
So that is essentially what was happening here earlier in the week when we were under a tornado watch. And, you know, for a couple hours, it looked like we might get a storm. But then ultimately, those of us here in Columbus, and we didn't get it. It stayed further south.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is this is just basically telling you what the public needs to be thinking about when a watch is issued is you need to be paying attention to what the weather will become and listening for more information that says that a warning is issued, which is when a storm is either currently producing a tornado or about to produce a tornado. And for me, we think of the watch as sort of the ready stage, to where now you need to be preparing yourself to be in a place where you can get information and know what you're going to do if a warning is issued. And then when the warning is issued, you take protective action.
We also want to hear from you this hour. Do you have questions about how tornadoes form, what to do to be prepared? You can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email your questions to allsides@wosu.org. So let's circle back to the 50th anniversary of the tornado that devastated Xenia. Did that change the way we track tornadoes? Because it feels like a real seminal moment, especially when it comes to advanced warning.
There were several things that it had at least some influence on. There were things that were already starting to happen that perhaps it accelerated. The research into using Doppler radar on a research side that eventually became the Doppler radars that we currently use had begun a few years before that. The processing was slow enough that we actually couldn't see the velocity data in real time. You had to go back after the fact and process. And I think there was a little bit more support that came on for that. One of the big things that came out of April 3rd was the understanding that we needed to do a better job of communicating information. At that time, the NOAA, what became the NOAA Weather Radio Network, had I think maybe 50 stations in it, and they were all in big cities. Well, that number is now well over 300 stations. And that's sort of the quickest and most direct way to get warnings. And it forms a big part of how, in fact, media and emergency managers get the warnings, is essentially they can instantly get them when that happens. The other thing that happened was that it really provided the biggest emphasis for us to do formal damage surveys. Ted Fujita out of the University of Chicago, this was the really first, he had done some experimenting with doing damage surveys, actually going all the way back to the Japanese atomic bombs when he was living in Japan. But for tornadoes, when he came to the U.S. in the 1950s, he started trying to see what damage occurred with tornadoes. And really, the April 3rd was the first big effort to do that. He was able to get graduate students and aircraft to fly over a lot of damage pads. And within a few years, the National Weather Service was then starting to do damage surveys and assess damage of tornadoes in almost their immediate aftermath. And it also, the other thing that happened was that it began the process which eventually a decade later led to some of the reorganization of the National Weather Service to improve the way we do warnings. Now, that took a long time to get set up and to get everything in place, but that was sort of the seeds came out of that kind of a time frame.
One of the questions that we were debating here at WOSU was, there's this theory that gets bandied about that Columbus, like downtown where we're located, won't see a tornado because it's hotter than the rest of the surrounding area, that it's sort of a heat dome. Is there any truth to that?
No.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know.
And we've got lots of evidence. I mean, we just, in the last quarter century, we've seen downtown Fort Worth, downtown Miami, downtown Nashville all get hit. The most damaging tornado in U.S. history, if you adjust for, you know, wealth over the course of the country, hit St. Louis in 1896 and crossed the Mississippi River right where the arch is right now. And that was, at that time, that was a heavily built up area. So, yeah. You know,
wishful thinking.
The reason downtowns don't get hit is they aren't that very big. You know, if you look at how big the urban core is in the United States, you know, it's less than 1% of the area of the country. So if it was like me and just throwing darts randomly at a dartboard, the chances of me hitting a downtown is pretty small. Now, a professional dart player might do a whole lot better than me, but that's really all that's going on, is they aren't very big.
And if you've heard myths or theories about where tornadoes go or how they happen, and you want to get fact from fiction, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513. Does the time of day have any effect on intensity or likelihood?
Likelihood, yes. Intensity, no. We don't really see anything that says anything about, if a tornado occurs, that there's really any big impacts. Most tornadoes occur in sort of the late afternoon, early evening. Now, that, you know, that's not a guarantee of anything. And again, we come back to the fact that in the plains, that window is narrower. In the Oklahoma City area, where I live, 75% of tornadoes are on the ground between 5 p.m. and 9 p.m. So we have a really good, and in fact, that helps us in some senses with our response, because that's a good time of day to get messages to people. They tend to be at home doing normal activities. That window gets wider as you go east, particularly as you go southeast. Where you are, the window is wide. If you go south of Ohio, you get down into Alabama, Mississippi. It's not quite flat. It still peaks in the late afternoon, but they get... In places, they'll get 30% of their tornadoes will occur overnight or during the earlier part of the day.
One of the things that a lot of people noticed when we had the tornadoes touch down in March was rapid lightning. It was almost like the universe was flicking a light switch on and off very quickly. Is that a hallmark of tornadoes? Because it seemed very unusual.
I wouldn't say it's a hallmark of tornadoes. It happens sometimes with storms like that. But we also know that we've seen relatively low lightning storms that have produced tornadoes. Lightning is basically telling us that there's a lot of ice in the storm that's moving fast. Because essentially what you're seeing is as the air moves, it's and the ice particles collide with each other, you're essentially stripping electrons off of them, and that forms the basis for the charge. So lightning's an indicator that there's ice in the storm. And a lot of it means there's probably just a lot of ice moving around a lot.
So it could maybe be a more of an indicator that you're going to get hail?
Yes, but it's a little more complicated because hail, we care about hail for size. A lot of the lightning's occurring with stuff that's pretty tiny pieces of ice that will melt before it gets to the ground. And you may see that as large raindrops. I mean, that's one of the things. If you see a large raindrop, that was probably a hailstone not very far up above off the ground.
Oh, that's really interesting. So, you know, when we heard, you know, it's funny, like we were told that there was a tornado warning, and I think it was the frequency of just having had one that was pretty bad. But everyone was like, oh, that was kind of a dud. And it really wasn't a dud for like Southern Ohio and Kentucky and Indiana. But I guess, you know, some people chalk that up to, oh, the weather guys got it wrong. But it's really a sense of that like extra preparation, right? Like had it come northward, it probably would come back through Franklin and Delaware counties.
Yes, and there's a real issue that this is a there's a problem that's larger than weather forecasting. It's almost all walks of life that rare events that have what we think of as what we call asymmetric costs. That if the bad thing happens, it's really costly, and if the bad thing doesn't happen and you took action for it, that cost wasn't that high. And so it's the same thing kind of in medical diagnosis of, you know, that we probably, in some sense, we overwarn on those things as well. But that because of, you know, if you have a really dread disease, that's an uncommon disease, you're willing to take a little bit of extra, didn't need to treat you, but in exchange for the fact that if you would have gotten the disease and not treated it, it would have been a really bad outcome. And it's the same thing in the tornado world, is that obviously the cost of missing an event and having an event unwarned is a lot higher than whatever precautionary actions you take that prevent it. But the tornadoes are pretty rare events. Even in environments that are favorable, not every storm makes a tornado.
That was Harold Brooks, a senior scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You too. We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to talk about how the Midwest is outfitted to withstand tornadoes. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking twisters this hour, and whether tornado touchdowns are becoming more common here in Ohio. Joining us now to discuss how the Midwest is outfitted to withstand these tornadoes is Stephen Strader, a professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at Villanova University. Welcome to All Sides, Stephen.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
So 50 years ago, a tornado devastated Xenia. It was the deadliest tornado of the 1974 season and the deadliest one Ohio has ever seen. one of the key takeaways was that we need to be better prepared. Xenia didn't have tornado sirens. Most buildings didn't have clearly marked shelters. So was Xenia a turning point?
I would say that the whole entire 1974 super outbreak was a turning point. We had already really started making progress on what we call tornado mortality and looking at how many people are being killed sort of per 1 million residents in the U.S. And the 1925 tri-state tornado was kind of the peak of that, that went across states like, you know, Missouri and Illinois and Indiana. And from that point on, we've seen declines in sort of the number of people killed by tornadoes. But 1974 was, you know, prior to Doppler radar installation. And it was also kind of prior to the world we live in now, thinking about social media and sort of the way that society has evolved. And that whole event is still etched in a lot of people's brains. And even people like myself who weren't alive during the event have studied it and examined it. And we kind of experienced our own in, say, 2011 with April 27th outbreak in the Southeast.
I want to quickly mention that we invited the Ohio Department of Emergency Management to take part in today's show. Unfortunately, they weren't available. So I do have to ask, why do some people not adequately take steps to prepare for natural disasters? And what are we trying to do to change their minds?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, as someone who's a meteorologist, but also a geographer, I work a lot with social scientists who, and many of them are also trained meteorologists themselves in severe weather science. And what we've learned really over the last 20 years, and maybe we knew this before, but we're starting to make progress, is that we're doing pretty good on the technology side. I mean, there's always improvements. We can start, you know, see tornadoes sooner than before, the rotation, you know, we technology has continued to increase, but not until really the last 20 years, we've seen a big push with the social sciences, which is getting to people's cognitive biases and how they think about threats. And what it comes down to a lot of times for people is very similar to the same mentality as rolling the dice at the craps table, is they're taking a calculated risk. And those calculations aren't always really thinking about safety. They're thinking about what they can do. Like if you're at work and you have to leave work to get to shelter, what if your boss tells you that you'll be fired, but you need the paycheck, but right? So there's pressures coming from both societal, and we like to think everybody will drop what they do and take the tornado warning seriously. But we find that there's barriers put in place, and those barriers are not about seeing the tornado with radar and looking at them or looking at the data. It's about understanding what people can and can't do and why they choose to do what they do. That's inherently sociology, not meteorology. So inter-science, interdisciplinary research is really pushing this forward.
What do you think the biggest risk factors are when it comes to surviving tornadoes? Like they tell you to get in the basement, but beyond that, there's not a lot of guidance.
Yeah. So the language coming from the National Weather Service issuing these warnings, and even the lead up to those warnings, the in days to sort of 3 or 4 days out, the day of, an hour before, the watch issues, there's cascading information that people need to be able to absorb. But even I think about some of our most vulnerable people, which are those that mostly live in manufactured housing. Those structures are not necessarily built to withstand tornadic winds. And the quality of the construction isn't as strong as, say, a permanent home with a fixed foundation. The issues with that is that people don't have anywhere to go. They may not get the warning in time to get to their shelter. And frankly, most people living in manufactured homes are already, you know, not living there by choice. They're living in them because it's affordable housing. And that's, again, sort of shows that they're extremely vulnerable relative to, say, someone living in a nice concrete foundation house. So it's really having a place to shelter and being able to make that decision. It's efficacy that they struggle with, not necessarily knowledge. And that's always something I think about a lot.
I want to take a call from Mike in Toledo. Welcome to All Sides, Mike.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I was hoping that your guest would comment on the Skywarn weather spotting system and amateur radio operators in particular.
Yeah, I would say that they're valuable. Eyes that can look at the sky and report to the official authorities and communicate that is extremely critical. One of the things that we know is that one of the best life-saving pieces of technology is radio, not necessarily ham radio or anything like that, but I'm thinking NOAA weather radio, where if all else fails, you have a battery backup radio, you can still get the warning if your power's out before the tornado comes. So those people with eyes on the sky and just hobbyist meteorology enthusiasts, I should say, are valuable to the community because they provide a network of communication, but also a network of verification. When an event occurs, they take pictures. And now we all walk around with smartphones and we can communicate that a lot better. So the more the merrier, in my opinion.
Thanks for the call,
Okay.
Mike.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
You know, yeah, there are storm chasers all over social media, and they popped up all over Ohio in recent weeks.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to like follow them and watch them work.
Yeah, it's something that's a bit of a catch-22 at times, where you have a lot of hobbyists that aren't trained and go through some of the, there's consequences to issuing a warning. There's consequences to not issuing a warning. There's also a tech, meteorology we like to think is sort of black and white to the public, but good meteorologists know that a good forecast takes a lot of subjective input and experience and training. And people go to school for that. And people are surprised at how much math and how much science is required to do this. And that's improved over the years. And we have to be aware that you need to get your information from a credible source first. And then everybody else after that typically pulls information from those credible sources, like TV meteorologists pull information from models that are run through federal programs. So when we think about who do we trust, I always suggest people put their faith in the National Weather Service, and then their local TV meteorologist. Those are some of the more experienced individuals that are dealing with this in a very professional manner. And you won't deal with people that you don't know that are maybe making suggestions on what to do. So you have to sort of figure out the credibility on your own. But of course, we have programs and groups like the National Weather Service that kind of do that for us. If you pay taxes, you're paying for that service.
And if you want to join our conversation this hour, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides at wosu.org. In the years that you've been researching tornadoes, are you seeing any changes in the patterns, like tornadoes popping up in new places or frequency?
Yeah, so we like to look at hazards, particularly atmospheric hazards, with through a lens of sort of scrutiny and figure out, are we seeing the underlying conditions of the atmosphere changing because of climate change? And if you look at heat waves, cold, rain, or precipitation, I should say, even wildfires, we've really increased our knowledge about how climate change is not only influencing these events, but whether we can detect that climate change is actually causing events. All the way at the bottom of that list is severe and convective weather, which is hail, severe wind, and tornadoes. And that's because they're so fine scale and they're very hard to resolve and understand in our climate models. But we're making progress. There's people like Dr. Victor Gensini and Dr. Harold Brooks, Dr. Walker Ashley. There's a lot of really great climate researchers out there that are looking at the future of severe weather. And what we've seen is fairly interesting. We've seen, I wouldn't say it's a shift, but we've seen works from Dr. Victor Gensini and Harold Brooks have looked at sort of that shifting of not, I don't like to use the term tornado alley, but we're seeing more favorable tornado environments slightly in places like the Mid-South, centered around Memphis. And that's problematic for me as someone who's a meteorologist and geographer and thinks about hazards, is there's a lot more people in Memphis than there is in central Kansas. So those impacts will go up. And we're actually working on current research right now that's looking at the relationship between those two pushing factors, the climate change aspects and the societal change aspects. Unfortunately, we live in a world right now where both are changing and both are not changing in our favor.
I want to take a call from Nayla in Blacklick. Welcome to All Sides.
Yes. Well, I wanted to give you guys a call. One of the things tornadoes do is they bring down trees, especially trees near power lines. And I have been happing and yapping at my neighbors all around me saying you've got unsuitable forest trees, silver maples, white pines, various other forest trees, especially near house with split trunks. Take them down now. Don't wait. And I started taking mine down in three sets over 20 years. Well, I woke up at 6:15 in the morning with an enormous house shake as roughly 30 trees in my immediate area came down. And then the siren for the tornado went off 15 minutes later when it was dead calm. But my neighbors had full-sized forest giants coming down all over Black Lake. And it was totally preventable. I'd actually told these people, hey, your cherries have borers. Hey, this is a split trunk. And I said, damn it, I worked for the USDA 30 years and know what I'm talking about. And they just didn't believe me. So, you know, I have one neighbor. She still has stuff going through, and they're loading up what looks like we're in the north woods of Michigan, all over Black Lake, and it was avoidable. Urban trees are not forest trees, and vice versa, especially those that are growing around AEP's power lines.
Yeah, that's such a difficult. You always see those trees that are like crazily cut around the power lines, and I wonder about those too.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, we see people doing landscaping in the western half of the U.S. because of wildfires, and that actually is shown to drastically reduce the probability of your house catching on fire if a wildfire does occur. And we should encourage that people take care of their trees. Particularly, we've had quite a number of deaths in the U.S. where trees have fallen on homes and cars and killed people. So it is something to take seriously. As my parents live in southern Indiana, and they had a part of their tree come down because of an ice storm. Well, they cleaned it, took the tree. That spring, they had a very bad windstorm, and the neighbor's trees all came down. And if that they wouldn't have taken down that tree, it would have landed on my parents' house. So it is important. One quick note is we shouldn't rely on tornado warnings to get the warning. Tornado warnings are sort of left over from Cold War times. They're not meant to be heard when you're inside your house. They're actually meant to be heard outside. They should not be used as a primary way to get tornado warnings. You should have a NOAA weather radio or some other means to receive the warning, because likely the warning was going off before you heard it. And so just be aware that that's sort of the recommended is to get a NOAA weather radio for maybe $10 at the local grocery store.
That's a great point. I want to take another call from James in Clintonville. Welcome to All Sides.
Hey, thanks. I live in a roughly 100-year-old Dutch colonial, which has a basement. Probably the top 4 feet of it is above ground level. And in the front of the house, so there's a very big main room in the basement on the south side, which has a bunch of glass block windows. And in the north of the house, there's about there are two rooms that are different. They're about 10 feet deep. The one on the west has a concrete slab that seems unsupported under a single-story porch. And on the west side of that, there's an old unused coal chute. And the room on the east is smaller. The ceiling's a bit higher, and it's basically the same wood flooring under the rest of the house. And there are no windows or openings in that corner of the foundation. So where would be my most safe place to shelter in that house? And I would mention also that in the center of the house, there is a stairwell that I could shelter under, although it's open around it.
You know, that's a good question, because not everyone has a basement. And in my house too, we have half of the basement is that, you know, half underground, half not underground.
Yeah, I would say the best place, the number one strategy to sheltering from tornadoes is to get low to the ground as possible. If it's a basement, yes. If you live in a concrete slab home, which I grew up in, you don't have a basement. So what you want to do is you want to put as many walls between you and the outside as possible. So, and you want to try to protect things from falling on you. So under the stairwell, if it's in the center of your home, is a great place to take shelter. You know, one other thing you can do is you can prep your shelter region before you have to use it. So you can, like we've seen people put bicycle helmets, blankets, covers, something to put over the top of you, because a lot of people that perish in tornadoes or get hurt is because of flying debris or structures collapsing on them. So if you can get under something sturdy and protect your head from blunt force trauma through bicycle helmets, infants, if you have a car seat that not in the car, but outside of it, you can put them in that. It all depends on how much time you have, but you should prep your shelter place now. And actually yesterday was National sort of shelter safety day, and people are taking safe place or shelter selfies and sharing them on social media. And those are great things to do. So center of your house, lowest levels possible, and try to cover yourself.
So that's why you hear interior bathrooms sometimes being a good
Yes.
place.
Yeah, because there's plumbing to support that, and also they t bathrooms tend to be an interior part of a lot of homes. That may have changed with recent structures, sizes, and designs, but ultimately, as many walls between you and the tornado is ideal.
We have another call from Cindy in Akron. Welcome to All
Hello.
Sides. Hi.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, All Sides. I like your program. Thank you. I have a question for Assistant Professor Strader. The question is this: cloud seeding, is it performed in 2024, yes or no? And what studies with the impact for intended and unintended areas and consequences? And three, are there any studies the impact of the jet stream and El Nino due to cloud streaming, meaning if it goes from one state like Texas, I believe they do it, plus four other states continue to do cloud seeding to make it rain, El Nino and the jet stream will blow it to some other unintended area, possibly causing tornadoes. Is there a study on that, Professor, Assistant Professor, Assistant Professor Strader?
Yeah, so there has been some history with cloud seeding, but it's been on very fine scales. And we have to be aware that the atmosphere is a very, very big thing. Tornadoes themselves have energies that are, the storms that produce tornadoes have energies that are comparable to nuclear weapons in terms of energy release. So releasing chemicals or whatever it might be to using cloud seeding has not really been proven to do anything, whether it hurts or help. And of course, so I would say there's probably some ideas of studies going on, but I'm not aware, and that's just not my expertise about who's practicing this. But ultimately, it's kind of still a bit of a pseudoscience in my opinion. So I wouldn't put too much weight into it. In terms of El Nino and the jet stream, there's a lot of researchers out there that are looking at teleconnections, the relationship of oceans, temperatures, and patterns on the upper level atmosphere. And of course, those influence the jet stream. But there's other teleconnections that, besides El Nino and Enzo, that influence these conditions. I would say that these types of environments can be conducive of producing severe weather that can then produce tornadoes. But it's not solely controlled by that. And honestly, the connection between, say, something like El Nino and whether a storm produces a tornado is not really there. There's other factors that are more localized that play a much bigger role, like the local winds in the region and the different sort of structures of the storms and the parent system coming through. What we do know, though, is that these long teleconnections that deal with severe weather are being used to potentially look at the potential for severe weather 2 to 3 weeks out. And that means 2 to 3 weeks before the severe weather happens, they're able to say, hey, in the next few weeks, conditions may be elevated for severe weather potential. But connecting it to where tornadoes are occurring is not something that we're doing as a field yet. We just don't have the capabilities, nor is there really strong physical backing for understanding that connection.
That was Stephen Strader, professor in the Department of Geography and the Environment at Villanova University. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, I appreciate it for having me. Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking about homes being built to withstand high winds. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. With experts warning that early storms are increasing possibilities, we're looking at the impact that they could have on Ohio. We just discussed how communities can better prepare for these storms, but what about our buildings? Joining me now is Mark Levitan, a research wind engineer for the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Welcome to All Sides, Mark.
Good morning.
So you've made it your mission to, quote, tame the destructive impacts of storms. So I'm hoping you can explain why you say it's the weaker tornadoes that do more property damage every year.
Well, there's about 1,250 reported tornadoes per year on average, right? Some years more or less. The vast majority of those tornadoes are the weaker tornadoes, the EF 0, 1, and 2, with wind speeds, you know, from sort of 60 to 135 miles per hour. Those represent sort of something like 97% of all the tornadoes. And so that combined with the fact that even the small number of the more intense tornadoes, the EF3s, 4s, and 5s, most of the land area that is impacted by those more intense tornadoes is actually covered with the lower wind speeds, right? We have the most intense wind speeds near the middle, and then they decrease as you move out. So if we look at all of the tornado damage that occurs in a year, much of it, maybe around half or so, is actually occurring from tornadic winds that are sort of EF2 or less, which is more the less intense, or if you're farther away from the core of a larger tornado. So we can make by designing for that, we can have some significant improvements. We don't have to design for the worst tornado. If we want to design for the worst tornado, then you put in a storm shelter or a safe room.
So basically, don't get so caught up in preparing for the worst that we don't take smaller, simpler steps.
Exactly. Like in right now in engineering design, in New York, we don't design for the impact of a Category 5 hurricane. Could it happen? Yes, but it's pretty unlikely. In South Florida, yes, we do design as a regular course of design for impact of Category 5 hurricanes because they're more likely there, right? So we don't design always for the worst possible case. We design for the more common case to meet engineering requirements for reliability and probabilities of failure.
You helped write a new national standard for tornado-resistant design. And I read that you began after the deadly tornado swept through Joplin, Missouri back in 2011. So what did you see there that made you think we need to change how we're building structures?
Yes, that was like your local Xenia, Ohio tornado. That was a devastating tornado in Joplin in 2011. That was the single deadliest tornado since we began keeping official records in 1950, with 161 fatalities, 8,000 buildings damaged or destroyed, $3 billion. So also the costliest individual tornado at that time. And it said it took out basically a third of the city of Joplin, a city of 50,000 people. And it just became apparent to us as we're studying that event, that we can do something because we really had done nothing in the past. You know, some communities didn't even have tornado shelters, and building design, with the exception of nuclear facilities and specialized defense facilities and storm shelters themselves, beyond those, the word tornado didn't appear in the building code, right? We didn't design for tornadoes. as we learned from our research following that event, tornadic winds are very different from straight line winds. They have different characteristics. They change wind speed and direction, of course, very fast. They have strong updrafts, which increases the uplift on the roof. They have tornadic winds are slower near the ground as opposed to straight line winds, which are, tornadic winds are faster near the ground as straight line winds are slower near the ground. They get slowed down from friction. And so all these different properties of the tornado, we've used those and built those into our new procedures to design for tornadic winds.
So you're designing for wind shear, essentially.
But wind shear is a component that's sort of the changing directions at different levels of the atmosphere. Wind shear is a component of a necessary component to actually create a tornado. Once we have that tornado moving, and we go to design a building for those tornadic wind speeds. Again, these wind characteristics are different in the tornado, mm-hmm. and so we have to account for those in the procedures that we use to design buildings, which we have not done before.
So what would you change, say, about the average suburban home with, like, the siding and the shingle roofs? Like, how could we do that different or better?
Okay, sure. The most important thing in residential construction is to make sure we have a strong, continuous load path. And what that is we have to connect everything from the shingle on the roof all the way down to the foundation with a strong connection. One of the most important things, for example, for all wind resistance, all kinds of winds, not just tornadoes, is to be able to have your roof decking is attached to the rafters, right? The 2x6s or 2x8s that are support the roof. Those rafters get attached to the top plate of the wall. Especially in the Midwest, oftentimes that connection is a toenail, right? You kind of nail something in. It's enough to keep the rafter from sliding around. It damages the wood. It doesn't have very much uplift resistance. What we really want to have there is something called a hurricane clip, because we use it in hurricane country. It's a metal clip which connects onto the rafter from the roof, and then it connects down through and it connects to the wall stud, so that when that wind comes and it tries to take the roof off and uplift the roof, wait a minute, I've got a steel connector here, not just a toenail that broke the edge of the wood, whatever. I've got a strong connection there to take it down to that stud. At the bottom of the wall, you want to have another steel connector that wraps the stud into the sole plate or the bottom plate of the wood. And then you need anchor bolts to hold that to the slab. So we need to have, most important thing, we need to have a strong connection with the load path. The other item is we want to make sure that the roof stays on. And so we want to have a strong connection of the roof deck. So when we have our plywood or oriented strand board down to the rafters, we want to either have that screwed down instead of nailed down, or if it's nailed, you want to have ring shank nails instead of the smooth shank nails. That gives you much more pullout resistance to make sure that the roof decking doesn't come off in this high wind.
You know, those don't sound like terribly expensive changes to how we design and build our houses.
No, they're not. They're very modest.
Yeah, it almost sounds like, to a certain extent, it's something you could retrofit, too.
If you're doing a re-roof, especially, like, hey, we had a hailstorm, we got to go in, the roofs, but, you know, shingle roofs last, you know, 15 to 25 years on average without damage, and so they have to be replaced on a pretty regular basis. Sure, you can go back in. You may be able to, depending upon how the house is framed and if you have a big overhang or not, you might be able to get in either through underneath through the soffit, or you could potentially take off the edge sheet of plywood or go through that to be able to get the hurricane clips. If you can't do that, though, at least certainly can go re-nail the deck back with ring shank nails, right? That's a very easy thing to do. Another important feature would be to what we call do a secondary moisture protection on the roof. And that's going to do is, even if you have some modest damage and lose some roof shingles, it's going to keep the water out of the building. And so what that means is basically you seal all the joints between the plywood with a special sealing tape, or there's a special underlayment that you can put on beyond just the basic roofing felt. And so even if you lose some roof shingles and those sorts of things, hey, we can try and keep if the wind speeds aren't so high and the damage isn't so much where you're really damaging and creating other openings in the building, that'll help keep the water out. And again, all this stuff is great for thunderstorms and derechos and all these other windstorms that we have, not just tornadoes. These are all because that's the weakest point link in especially in our housing is the roofing construction.
Well, that's really good to know. You know what also surprised me about the last one that touched down here in northern Ohio was the number of like lawn chairs and giant trampolines and all these other things that got blown all over the neighborhoods, and I think caused way more damage than if they had been put away.
Yeah, that's a little bit tougher in tornado country and high wind country. You know, in the hurricane prone regions, you have a couple days warning and you can try and get all that stuff and put it in the garage, all the loose things. But that is more of a challenge. We do have options, and there are building and construction materials to have impact resistant windows. They're kind of laminated windows. Those cost something on the order of twice as much as a regular window. But those then provide protection from windborne debris.
That was Mark Levitan, a research wind engineer for the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. Thank you so much for all your information today.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.